Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Chico author and musician Brian Kramer views his life on this planet as comprised of four seasons. He previously published a memoir of the springtime of his life, which recounted his first 20 years. Brian Kramer was a public school teacher when he turned 40 in 2003, and he has now published Summer, the Second 20 Years, My Memoirs. Brian Kramer, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So explain how you set up this, how you got this idea to write a memoir that was not enclosed in just one volume.
Years ago, just thinking about the seasons and how fresh and lively spring is, and I thought babies are like spring, and that was what set me off on this idea of spring is actually an allegory for our lives. And I actually think there's a higher power that ordains that. So I think spring is, this book, Spring, the first 20 years, my memoirs, I covered those first 20 years, and it was a very rough, tumultuous, difficult 20 years. And at the same time, it was a period of incredible growth and really preparing me for the summer and the fall and eventually the winter.
Of your life.
Of my life.
When you say it was a tumultuous first 20 years, can you give us an idea of what that was like?
Sure. I would say that the earliest thing that was difficult was being sexualized very young, about 8 or 9 years old. And I think that that set off what might have been a problem anyway, but maybe wouldn't have, with having obsessive compulsive disorder. So I started washing my hands compulsively at a very young age and really kind of equating the sexualization with the washing of the hands. And then that turned into a lot of other obsessions and compulsions. And I was religious, and so I did have some benefit of believing in a loving God, but I also had some what I consider negative ideas about real negative forces in the universe, too. And so it made it very complicated. So without going into too much detail about that book, it was a challenging elementary school and high school years.
Well, now you mentioned the terms obsessive compulsive disorder, but you didn't know that in these first 20 years of your life, did you?
No, I didn't know what that was until I took a course in psychology in high school. And when I read a description of what that encompassed, I was just in awe that that clearly described what I was experiencing.
In fact, you went on to study psychology in
Yes.
college. You have a bachelor's degree in psychology and in health science and social science. My guest is Brian Kramer, and he has written his second memoir, Summer, the Second 20 Years, My Memoirs. So you wrote the first 20 years, you published that, and now here's your second memoir, which covers the second 20 years of your life. And I want to skip to the very end of this memoir when you are 40 years old, and you wrote a letter to your dad, and you hadn't always, well, what had been your relationship with your dad?
I had had a good relationship with my dad. He was always a great listener, and I felt really good about our relationship.
Well, what did you write to your dad? And this was, again, you were 39, 40 at the time you wrote this.
Yes, I would have been 39, because this was January 2nd of 2003. I wrote, "Dear Dad, how can I ever express the gratitude that I feel in my heart for you? I think back over all the years of growing up, and I realize what patience and what understanding you always had for me. I can't remember a time when you were ever harsh or mean. I remember many, many times when you listened to me, seemingly endlessly, and tried to comfort and understand me. You could easily have become angry or given up or decided I was crazy or something. Perhaps at times you were tempted to think so, but you never ever conveyed that. You were a rock for me. You were confident of reality when I wasn't. You understood life. You understood fears and imaginations and guilt and forgiveness. You let me know that you loved and accepted me without anger or judgment. You always demonstrated that you also loved and accepted all people without anger or judgment. I want you to know how much I appreciate that quality in you, tolerance. Sometimes I think that your tolerance is too much so, even bordering on license. But I think that really what you value so highly is believing the best about people, believing that they are valuable and are often motivated by things we don't understand and can't see.
This is author and musician Brian Kramer reading from his second volume of memoirs, Summer, the Second 20 Years. And Brian, this almost brought me to tears when I read what you wrote to your dad, because my experience is that so many sons did not have the experience that you had with this kind of dad. Hmm. So I'm sure you reached a point when you were turning 40 that you realized what extraordinary, is that too much praise for your dad, that you were lucky to have had a dad that was so understanding, because I hear so many stories of sons whose fathers were not like your dad.
Yeah, I appreciate him very, very much.
Well, we can't just assume that you only appreciated your dad, because you also appreciated your mother, and you also wrote a letter to your mother. And you said, during this time, this was Mother's Day of that same year, 2003, and you said, during this time, I grew to appreciate my mother more than ever in my life. And at this time, you were a full-time teacher, and you had been for 2 years. You said, being a full-time teacher opened my eyes to the challenges of raising children. So I'd like you to read a little bit from the letter that you wrote to your mother, Brian.
Okay. This was written on May 11, 2003. And I'll start here. Now is the season for harvest, the time for finding great satisfaction in the works of your hands. Each time I play the piano, I am grateful to you for encouraging me to learn how to play it. Little could you know when you talked me into taking lessons that your decision to encourage me in this particular thing would result in thousands of people, mostly the very old and the very young, enjoying the music. Little could you know that in times of great stress, anxiety, worry, and fear, that this ability to sit down and play my heart's feelings through the piano keys would bring me such comfort and peace and get me through the painful times. You have planted well, Mom. You have been and continue to be a great mother. I love you, and I'm able to say this and experience it and share it because you first loved me. By being my mom and by loving me, you taught me how to love as well. I'm so grateful for you, and I sincerely wish you not only a happy Mother's Day, but even more importantly, a happy motherhood, which is something you deserve to celebrate every day. Love, Brian.
And the Brian is Brian Kramer, and he wrote this letter to his mother when he was almost 40. The second 20 years of his life, his memoir, is Summer, the Second 20 Years. And you wrote this letter to your mother expressing your appreciation for what she had done in your life. And you have several moments when you express appreciation to people who have played an important role in your life. For example, you describe having gone into therapy at times in your life, and you had a therapist. Her name was Ann Dimmock. And when you came this in October of 2000, you said that was your 50th and final counseling appointment with her, Ann Dimmock. She was a gem of a therapist and a gem of a human being. I will forever be grateful to her for her role in my life. You said she helped me accept myself as a gay man and, more importantly, a man with the freedom to follow my heart and enjoy life and find happiness in being my authentic self. Now, you mentioned having been sexualized at a very young age, and then you struggled with, am I gay, am I not? And you even wrote a book about that. But this particular therapist, you said she was a gem of a human being. What a nice compliment.
So you asked about Ann Dimmock. She was a gem of a human being for me. And I enjoyed every session with her. But there's one particular session that stands out above all sessions. And I was relaying to her, I was kind of confessing my sexual behaviors, sins, whatever you'd call them, as a child. And I was telling her how bad this was and how wrong and everything. And she was saying, well, I really haven't heard anything other than normal childhood behaviors, but go ahead and tell me something really bad. And so I'd tell her more, and she said, okay, yeah, you haven't really told me anything bad yet, but keep going. Maybe you can come up with something. And I went thing after thing after thing after thing. And she just kept saying, I haven't heard anything bad yet. I'm only hearing normal childhood experimentation and behaviors. Can you tell me anything bad? And when I couldn't come up with anything bad, it was just profound. And it still brings me to tears to think about that.
And you said she helped you to be free. And that's another kind of a theme in your book, learning how to be free.
Yeah.
Now, you have so many experiences that you describe in your book. This is a period of time when you go to college. But you also had other adventures, I want to call them adventures, that sent you off to far-off places on the planet. And how did you happen to go to a place where they spoke Marshallese?
Well, at the time, I was working for Salvation Army as a caseworker here in Chico. And I had felt like God wanted me to join the organization and become a soldier. They call themselves soldiers within the Salvation Army if you join. And they considered me promising, and they wanted me to become a minister. And so my plan at the time was to become a minister in Salvation Army. And then they said, we'd like to send you out to Majuro on the Marshall Islands as a missionary in the summer before you go into training school. And so I was afraid of that. I called my dad. My dad said, I'm not going to tell you what you should do, but if it was me, I'd take the adventure. And so I said, okay, I'll go to Majuro. And they sent me off to Majuro.
So you were there just that summer. How did you like it there?
Oh, gosh. It was such a mixture of things. First of all, the place itself is just beautiful. It's coral reefs, and I've never, ever swam around with brilliant blue, purple, yellow, orange, white fish, all these multicolored fish, just gorgeous. There were some moray eels, though, that were rather scary. And we were told that if one bites you, you have to relax the area of your body that it bites. Because if you get tense, it will just hang on tighter. But if you relax that part, it'll let go. I thought, how in the world would I possibly relax whatever it bites?
With a moray eel.
With a moray eel, it's clamped down on me. But it was beautiful, and at the same time, it was such an emotionally draining place to be. I had felt called into the Salvation Army, and then suddenly I was thinking, man, I just have so many disagreements with the organization. As much as I admire the work they do great work, but I also didn't care for the theology that was coming with it. And so for the whole couple months, I just struggled with, why would I feel that God called me into this organization and now I don't want to go? Am I disobeying God? And ultimately,
because you had planned to go into training right after this.
As soon as I got home, I was going to go into training.
Rancho. You were going to.
I was going to. Yeah.
You rethought that decision.
I did.
You know what else, too? You talked about the people there on this island. It's a tropical paradise. They could be eating coconut, but that's not what they're eating.
No. In fact, I was friends with a nurse there, and she was telling me that several children every day were starving to death on that atoll. The parents were feeding them just white rice and imported goods from the United States and Australia. Sodas, all this garbage from all over the rich world. And she said if they had just eaten a papaya a day, those little kids would survive. But these parents were thinking that they wanted to be like the rich people, you know, in the U.S. and Australia and other places. And And it was tragic. And also that there was no way to get rid of trash. So these people were importing all these goods from around the world. If you wanted to collect aluminum cans, it would have been heaven, because there were literally millions of aluminum cans along the coral reef, all along the reef. And the nurse told me that there were hypodermic needles coming back up because they were being thrown out into the ocean and they would just wash up on shore. There was so much trash, and there was nothing to do with it. They had a trash area, and it just smelled so bad. You just open the van door, throw out your trash, and hold your nose and close it and take off. It was very sad, as well as being so beautiful.
My guest is memoirist Brian Kramer, and I'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is Brian Kramer, and he's describing his experience when he was thinking he would take training in the Salvation Army, and he goes off for the summer and describing the experience he had on this island in the Pacific. And it saddens us to hear this reality that you faced when you were there.
You know, this atoll, Majuro, is also in the news lately because the head of the atoll is describing what's happening with global warming as genocide because his people are under threat of the complete atoll just going underwater. The highest point on this atoll was just about 4 to 6 feet because there was a little bridge. But that coral reef sits right on the ocean, and the most of it is just a foot to 2 feet above sea level. So with global warming, it's predicted that in a relatively short time that atoll will be gone. So they're already making plans to move the people.
So you go off and you have this experience, which was a little uncomfortable, I say that, at the time. But then when you come back and become a teacher, you draw on these experiences that enrich your classroom teaching.
Yeah.
And I say these experiences because not only did you go off to this island in the Pacific, but you also have later an opportunity to go to Mexico.
Yes.
And have another adventure.
Yes.
And how did that adventure work out?
Oh my gosh, I loved the adventure of it. In terms of the provision of a higher power, I avoid using the word God too often because people immediately think of whatever their particular version of God is. I will say it sometimes if people know me well enough. But before I left, I felt like God had said, this trip, trust me completely for the provision. Don't ask anybody for money and trust that I'm going to give you exactly what you need the entire trip.
Now, this requires courage, Brian, because here you are going to a foreign country and you're being instructed by whatever people want to call this guidance, this inner guidance, if
yes.
you want to call it that,
mm-hmm.
to say, no, Brian, don't ask for money. I'll provide. It's kind of the impression you got. Well, okay, I'm just going to trust that things will work out.
Yes. And before I left, people were all asking me, well, how are you going to pay for it? And I said, I'm trusting God. And then they'd say, well, I'd like to give you some money. And they'd either give it to me. More often, they'd say they're going to send it later.
But didn't.
Some of them didn't. But anyway, I had enough to get a plane ticket from San Francisco to Guadalajara, and where my destiny was Tonalá, which is near Guadalajara. And so I made it down there. And things were going along fine until about a month in, I owed $50 to the missionary with whom I was staying. And I do not believe in owing. And so I told him, or I started writing a letter to one of the people who had promised to send money. And he noticed I was doing this. He said, I thought you told me God had said to trust him.
And here you are writing a letter requesting that somebody who said they would give you money and they hadn't done it yet. And what did your friend say?
Well, I said to him, I thought that's what God said. but I'm only writing to someone who already promised to send me money. He said, I think you should wait and just trust God. God said, don't ask. I think you should wait. So that very day, within an hour or two, I went down to the post office as I did every day, because anytime you live in a foreign country, you just crave letters. But anyway, I went down there, and that day there was a letter, and I opened it up, and in there was a check for $50, the exact amount I needed. And it was from someone who had never promised to send anything. And
And they had mailed it 2 weeks prior.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I believe in a higher power. Absolutely. I have no doubt. There's so many things in this book. In fact, I call this book the Book of Miracles, because I shouldn't call it that, because there's a course in miracles. But anyway, I call it a Book of Miracles. And
because this wasn't the only time. You count so many times when you trust this inner guidance that you get. And I think some people, Brian, if they don't know you, would say, Brian, you're hearing voices. Oh, my goodness, we better send him away. He's hearing voices, and not only hearing them, he's doing what they instruct him to do.
Hmm.
Do you get people questioning you, Brian, your sanity?
I don't worry about it. If I may tell you the rest of that story in Mexico.
That was really quite an event. The real adventure began when you tried to get home.
Yes. Oh, gosh. A couple weeks before I was scheduled to come home, I had this thought I believed from God that said save, and it was like 34,000 pesos. I don't remember the exact amount, but it was a very specific amount, 34,000 pesos. And I said, I thought about it, and I thought, I need to spend what little money I have for souvenirs, because there were people that sent me money in the course of being in Mexico. So I heard, save 34,000 pesos, and it was kind, not like I just said it. But anyways, and I ended up spending the money on souvenirs, even though I felt strongly. So I doubt myself sometimes. But anyway, the day came, and I didn't have the money actually to get the ticket to go home even. But I was praying and asking God to provide. And the day that I wanted to go home, when I had scheduled that I was going to be done with my responsibilities and I could actually leave on good terms with the missionary, that money, $200, came, a check.
And this is in dollars, which is the equivalent of...
Well, no, not that yet. No, I know you're thinking ahead. But the money that I needed for the plane ticket, exactly that amount arrived. So I ran down to the place where they sell the tickets, and the woman said, I'm so sorry, but we don't have tickets for a month because everybody's flying. There's been an accident on the U.S.-Mexican border. So I said, could you at least put me on a waiting list? And she said, yes, we'd be glad to. So so I got put on that list, and I left dejected. Oh, I also told her, if God wants me on this plane, God will get me on this plane. And so we both laughed, and I left. So that night I went to the bus station to see if maybe I could take a bus home, and it turned out that wasn't going to work out. But when I got back from there, it was late, but she was still in her office. And so I knocked, and I said, is there any chance that you've heard anything at all? And she said, no, I'm so sorry, but come on in and visit. So I went in, we started chatting, I made a joke about I'll ride a burro, I don't care how I get home, I just want to go home. While we're sitting here, now this is just a few hours since we first talked and I was going to wait a month. While we're sitting there, a courier from Guadalajara Airport came in, handed her a bunch of tickets for the day. She's leafing through them while we're talking, and then she says, Dios mío, which is my God. And I said, what? And she says, I can't believe this. There's a ticket in here for you. And I I said, when? She said, tomorrow morning. And oh my gosh, I just couldn't believe it. Okay, so I said, can you wait and let me run to the house and get the $200 and pay for the ticket? And she said, absolutely. So I ran home, I paid for the ticket. I got on the plane the next morning, and then there was a problem. And the problem was that I was going to be stuck in San Francisco with no money. I had only a quarter left.
25 cents.
Yes. And the price of a phone call. So I got into San Francisco, and I thought, well, I've got to call my Uncle Leonard. My Uncle Leonard had promised money, and he's a great uncle, but the money didn't come. So I felt it was okay to ask him to send me or to use a credit card and pay for my ticket from San Francisco, a bus ticket from San Francisco to Chico. And so that's what he did. So on my bus ride home, I hear this most loving, loving voice. I can't even describe it. This says, you've done really well, son. You did really well. But next time when I say save 34,000 pesos, I want you to save 34,000 pesos. And when I went home and did the conversion rate of 34,000 pesos into dollars, it was exactly what that bus ticket cost from San Francisco to Chico.
Because you got the airplane ticket to get you to San Francisco, and then you're stuck because you only have 25 cents,
yeah,
which is not going to buy you that bus ticket to
no.
get the rest of the way.
No. And every time I tell these stories, I just get teary-eyed because I feel it's been such a privilege to live like this. And it doesn't mean I'm always going to trust. It doesn't mean I'm going to not lose my faith or whatever, but I do believe that there's higher levels of consciousness, what people call angels, guardians, our ancestors, and the top God. I just believe that we're not alone in this universe. There's a reason for everything.
My guest is Brian Kramer, and he has composed his first memoir, which Volume 1, Spring, which he describes the first 20 years of his life. He has now completed Summer, the second 20 years, My Memoirs. And he describes the fact that he trusts this inner guidance that he gets. He calls it God. Other people might call it something else. But he listens to this inner voice. And you mentioned that we're not alone in this universe. And you specifically mentioned at one point in your memoir that the importance of touch, just the human touch, and this is on page 127, this is chapter 32 in your book. And part of your book, you say, do you ever think about how much time you spend each day in physical contact with another person? Read the rest of that paragraph, if you would, Brian.
If you're married, then you probably have a significant time each day that you are touching someone. If you have children, then your touch time is even more. If you're single, however, you may find, if you think about it, that you have an average of about 5 to 10 seconds of touch time per day. This might be made up of 3 2-second handshakes, 2 1-second pats on the back, and maybe a 2-second hug on a good day.
And I don't think people realize this. We know, we've seen studies that babies that are neglected do not thrive. And you say in your book, not only do babies need touch and young children, but also teenagers and young adults and middle-aged adults and older adults and the elderly. Everyone needs touch. And we see these wonderful stories. We see pictures of these therapy animals that go to hospitals and homes so that people can pet them and have that experience of touch. Your situation is a little bit complicated in that it would be easier, I think, for a woman to embrace each other.
Sure.
But now, if you put your arm around somebody of your same gender, would you be misunderstood?
Sometimes, yeah. It's just something that you have to have the courage to do if you want to. I've tried to have the courage to do that. And for the most part, I'm well received by people. People get to know me and then they trust me.
My guest is Brian Kramer, and he, in his first volume, describes the fact that he struggled with being gay. You even went through, they try to convert you and say, Brian, you're wrong to feel this way. And so you're still struggling in this second volume of your memoir. How did you resolve that?
Well, should I share the... Okay. There was a time when I was in Southern California and I was driving on the 210 and I had really come to accept myself again in spite of my religious beliefs that it was a sin. And when I was on the 210, I was thinking about all the things that were covered in this book, you know, all these miracles. And I said to God, really sincerely, I said, I don't know if you're going to need to send me to hell because of being gay, because of what Christians call your righteousness or your holiness or whatever. But I want you to know that I appreciate what we've had during this period, this 20 years, really at that point, close to 40 years, but a lifetime of feeling very loved by this higher power. And I want you to know that I am so grateful that even this time, I'm always going to be grateful to you, regardless of whether I might have to go to hell. And I just felt this overwhelming sense, just like when I heard God say, you've done a good job, son, on the trip. Now I heard, do you really think that I send people to hell like you? How many people are down there giving me permission to send them to hell while simultaneously thanking me for the time we've enjoyed? Brian, I don't send people like you to hell. And then I heard kind of my father's voice, use your brain, Brian. So,
because your religious experience, if I'll call it, went through a lot of changes. And you were did missionary work. But then toward the end of your book, and this is in chapter 38, you write in your journal, I'm sick of religiosity. Would you read that part in your book?
Right. Sure. I'm sick of what I consider religiosity, a going through the motions, taking collections, making people feel guilty, trying to get money out of them, saying amen at the end of a prayer without any realization of why we pray nor why we say amen. Listening to another boring sermon. I like to play the piano, but I don't like to lead worship. Same old song we've sung 100 times.
And so because of this, you say that you decided to give notice. So read that section, Brian.
Yeah, I don't know that we mentioned that I was playing the piano. I was hired to play piano and sing for a church. But shortly after this, I gave notice and was once again a free man. I no longer felt obligated to attend church. I had argued for a long time that church was not something that could be attended anyway. The church was the people, not the building. If our focus was on the people, we could never be bored. But if our focus was on the building or the program or anything other than the people, it could be nothing but boring.
So you have reached some conclusions that were quite different than when you started this journey. You were raised Catholic, by the way.
Yeah.
And then you... You say, I found a walk in the mountains more inspiring than a church service. Seagulls at the beach more worshipful than choirs. Common sinners more pleasant company than apparently less sinful Christians. And so you say, we need to be a family again. You have changed the way you describe how you would like to be religious. And what did you conclude about how you would like to be religious?
To me, we are all spiritual beings. I believe the universe is God, that we are all part of God. And so I think human beings, we try to understand what's going on and we create religions. But the bottom line is that we're called to love one another and help each other grow and mature, that true religion is love. It's of the heart.
Well, you had a friend who asked if you were attending church, and you wrote, "I stopped going to church about 2.5-3 years ago. I have only felt liberated. Church was boring. There's not been a moment when I've wished to be part of organized church again." So you said your bond was not so much with those who call themselves Christians, but those who call themselves truth seekers. "I'd rather fellowship with any human being, regardless of religious affiliation, who is seeking truth. Anyone who seeks truth will always arrive at the doorsteps of his or her creator. This is true religion, and this kind of faith brings peace, contentment, and pleasure." And this is the end. This is how you conclude this second season of your life, Brian, this summer.
Yes.
You wrote your first season as spring. And by the time you get to be 40, the second 20 years of your life, these are the conclusions that you have drawn.
What I'm finding is that the third season, of which I'm getting close to being at the end of the third season, has been not so much events. This was packed with events, but it's packed.
The current one I just published.
But the third one, fall, the third 20 years, is packed with insights. And I tend to think that's probably how life goes. People have a season of the summer, it's hard work, and you're planting all kinds of things. And then in the fall, you start reaping the harvest. And I think insights kind of replace a lot of activity. You kind of calm down and enjoy it more.
In fact, you say one method of stress reduction is to imagine yourself 50 years hence.
Yes.
And what would you be like? This is when you were 37. What would you be like as an 87-year-old?
Yes.
And how would that be, Brian?
Well, I was doing that back when I was teaching elementary school. It was very stressful. And so I was imagining myself at 87. So whenever a parent was complaining, immediately in my head, okay, I'm 87. And I just immediately felt calm, just listened. Okay, whatever. You know, I didn't say those words out loud, but in my mind, I gave myself permission how I imagined an 87-year-old would handle it. And it helped a lot. So I'm 56 now. If I had 50 years, I'd be 106. So I don't think I'm going to worry about things.
Well, you mentioned your teaching, and you were very successful as a teacher, but there were rough places. There were people who said, gosh, that guy's got ideas I don't agree with. And you often mention that you want to do things your way. You don't want somebody telling you what to do and how to do it. And that you think for yourself.
Yes. My father taught me to think for myself. My father is a man who, if you take too conservative of a view, he'll be the liberal. And if you take too liberal of a view, he'll be the conservative. I found it very frustrating as a child because whatever I said, he'd always take the other side. And then I'd say, Dad, if I had started on the other side, you'd be arguing the other. And we'd laugh together. So, yes, he's taught me to use my brain.
Well, we'll look forward to the fall of your life, Brian.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Brian Kramer, and he is writing his memoirs as the seasons of the year. He finished Summer, the first 20 years of his life. He has just now published Summer, after Spring, the second 20 years, my memoirs. Thank you, Brian.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman.
Pacific Coast Saudade. We are each other's as surely as song stitches breath to air. Tess Gallagher. Let no part of you hold itself closed. Let fear fall from the cliff's raw edge. Let your heart blast wide open to receive the starling's song. Let jasmine scent your breath and the hummingbird nectar your dreams, pollinate your whistling to a tune I played in your ear. Let ravens guard your gate while you sleep, and the little brown mole knows his way into your dreams. As sure as the Pacific will roll you, hold you, as you stretch your arms beyond the canoe's red hull, and lavender sunset spreads to tend your worries, to bear witness to the land's bitter breath as you stitch your sorrows into song. Amy Antone Giovanni.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Nick Hansen writes under the name N.J. Hansen and has been writing seriously since high school. He published his first book, The Last Stand of the Dragon, at the age of 27, and since has written four more. His second novel, An Empty Swing, was nominated for an American Fiction Award. His latest book, The Kingdom of Dadria, A Lamb Amongst Wolves, takes readers on an adventure of intrigue, romance, and monsters. Nick Hansen is a member of the California Writers Club. Nick Hansen, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I mentioned the California Writers Club. How did you get involved with them?
Originally, there was a writers group in Chico called CAPS, Chico's Authors and Publishers Society, that was eventually incorporated into the larger California Writers Club. It's a statewide club headquartered in Berkeley. It has branches across the state. So eventually, the CAPS became rebranded as the North State Writers and is now an official branch of the California Writers Club.
How did you even know about them?
After I'd published my first book, I was trying to market it, get involved with other writers' groups and things like that. And eventually some of those I got involved with pointed me towards CAPS. And some of those writers' groups eventually joined wholly into the North State Writers. So it was just a series of events pretty much after that first book. It was, okay, you have your book. What do you do with it now? Type of thing.
In fact, many writers say writing the book was the easy part. The real work began after they finished their book.
That is not a lie.
Well, but I was impressed that even as young as you were, you knew how to set about marketing your book by consulting other people who had the expertise that you wanted to acquire. Now, the title of this book, The Kingdom of Dadria, A Lamb Amongst Wolves, and how would you classify this kind of writing that you do? How would you label it if you had to categorize it?
For the genre of this book, this one is a epic high fantasy type of thing. So it is that world that's set in its own separate universe, like a Middle Earth or a Narnia type of world.
Made me think of. Yeah, mm-hmm. Like Narnia. Yeah. The cover of your book, somebody also was impressed that you used the word amongst, a lamb amongst wolves, and that kind of gave it a flavor of a bygone era.
That was the intention behind it, yes.
So we mentioned Narnia, and these must have been influences on your inspirations for writing this books like this.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of inspiration did you consult? Were you influenced by?
Well, originally the idea for the book was it was supposed to be very much a star-crossed lovers romance story. And it was supposed to be two people from two feuding families fall in love against all odds. And it was originally called The Sheep and the Wolf Clans. And eventually that started developing and changing a little bit. I got into Game of Thrones. That has some influence on it. And so that developed some of the aesthetics of the story. And that also helped codify some of the, okay, how do I still incorporate the quote-unquote sheep element into one of the families? And that eventually gave me the impetus of how I was supposed to figure that out.
My guest is Nick Hansen. He writes under his initials, N.J. Hansen. And his newest book is The Kingdom of Dadria, A Lamb Amongst Wolves. And what you were just saying helps to explain the cover, because until you read the book, you're wondering, I was wondering, well, how does this cover, what is the meaning behind this cover? I might mention your illustrator, Steve Fershad, is well known. He's a very popular illustrator.
He is fantastic illustrator. He gets pretty much everything right that I wanted about this cover he was able to do.
So he came up with ideas. He said, Nick, what about this? And
well, what it was, I have a little bit of a unique relationship. I will draw out the cover myself. So I drew the images, pretty much all the layout of it, and then I gave it to him to work off of. So then he was able to add his own style to it and also change some of the colors to influence that a little bit, because some of the colors I didn't have set out in mind. But he was able to figure out, okay, this should be that color to contrast this, and this should be this color instead. So he was able to still add some influence to the story, because some of the details, like the color of the banner and things like that, weren't set in stone until he gave me back the final edition, which then I incorporated into the story itself.
Well, since this is radio and you've been touching on some of these elements in the cover illustration, describe this cover for us.
Well, what we have, our main character, Endelin Ramborn. She is at center of the cover, and she's holding a spear, a wooden spear with an obsidian tip, up halfway through her face, so that on one half it displays a castle, a young prince, and the prince's bodyguard. And flapping over the castle is a banner of her house, the House Ramborn, which has a white rayox. A rayox is basically a large bighorn sheep. It's like a bighorn sheep the size of a horse. A white rayox against a red background on this banner. And on the other side of the cover, it is a forested landscape. It's supposed to be like a redwood forest, California redwoods. And you have a man who appears to be indigenous Native American, and behind him a wolf howling up at a full moon.
Because when I look at the left-hand side of the cover and I see this stone castle with ramparts and I think, oh, England. And this bodyguard's pretty scary looking himself, Nick. So on that side, I think, oh, it's set in England. And then on the other side is this, what looks like a Native American with this wolf howling at the moon on that side of it. So this, the setting, how would you describe the setting then for this story?
The setting is, it is a sort of like an alternate North America. The idea is that if European colonists came to the country, but about 1,000 years earlier, so they were still set in a medieval mindset. They still built the castles and had their kings and lords and their princesses and their knights. Instead of the Victorian era, it was old England type of thing. So it would have been the medieval era and Native Americans interacting instead of what eventually happened in our world.
My guest is N.J. Hansen, and his newest book is The Kingdom of Dodria, A Lamb Amongst Wolves. And he's described the cover for us. I would like for you now to, since we've been talking about the story, to read a little bit of this story. And what about when there's a character named Shunka? Am I pronouncing that right?
Shunka is how Shunka. I pronounce it. Okay. But it probably has a different pronunciation depending on who gives it.
And this character is given a vision that helps explain this story. So do you read a little bit of your book for us?
An enormous explosion of steam rose into the air. Instead of being extinguished, the flames grew larger and brighter. They roared louder than an angry bear. Lilac smoke filled the longhouse. Alo swirled his hands through the smoke, catching and changing it. He inhaled deeply through his nose and then breathed out his mouth. The shaman's eyes had turned the color of early morning fog. "This is strange," he murmured. "I see something for you." "Like what?" Shunka asked, more interested than before. "You will go on patrol. Just you, Tala, and Mingan. You will find someone out in the woods. A girl, one of the pale-faced people of the Wall Kingdoms," the shaman said. "Her hair is like fire, and eyes green as a sequoia pine." "Why do I care what she looks like?" Shunka said. "If she's from inside the walls and off the path, then she has no business being in our forest. She will be killed like all the others. This one you will not harm. Rather, you will protect her." Shunka balked at this. Protector, an outsider, one of the invaders that nearly destroyed our forest and used to hunt our people. Why would I protect anyone such as that? Because she is the Aliotse, the shaman said. Shunka's eyes snapped open. He tried to sit up, but the pain in his stomach wound forced him back down. You are serious? Some outsider girl is the Aliotse. The Great Spirit would never be so cruel to twist our fate like that. It'll never happen. The shaman was lost in his vision, his eyes drawn skyward with the smoke dancing around him. The Aliotse, the Great Mother, to think I would live to see the day of her return and the rebirth of the hero.
This is N.J. Hansen reading from his latest book, The Kingdom of Dadria, A Lamb Amongst Wolves. And who do you see as your typical reader, Nick?
A typical reader of this, I would say probably middle to high school age, middle grade to high school age type of young readers. It can be enjoyed by anybody older than that, of course. Somebody who is fond of the big, expansive world and the epic fantasy. This is a story that has lots of storylines and multiple characters all involved in them. So, not necessarily a light read by any means, but somebody who can get really invested in that sort of thing.
And you must have had fun because you were free to make up names. You could make up the setting however you wanted to. And so these names that you have given your characters too are quite creative.
Thank you.
I was wondering if J.R. Tolkien influenced your choice of using your initials instead of your name.
Probably a little bit, but a lot of other authors do that. Rowling yeah. did that.
Yeah, but I could see when a lot of times
Lewis
women do
it
so that it won't reveal the gender.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a pleasure talking to you about your new book, Nick, and I'm sure there's another one underway.
Oh, well, there's at least one more book in this series, probably a couple more after that, but I have a few more in the pipeline coming down the road.
Because this is a pretty thick one. If you had told more of the story, this would have been a really thick book.
That's sort of what made it have to be cut off when it was.
So this is volume one. We can look forward to a continuation of this story.
Yes, there is. The intention is for book two to come out in 2021.
Well, congratulations, Nick, and thank you for coming in today.
All right, thank you for having me.
I'd like to thank my first guest, memoirist Brian Kramer. His second memoir is Summer, The Second 20 Years, My Memoirs.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.